This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, you'll hear from Jill Bolster-White of Transitions Mental Health Association.
California now is thought to have 50% of the nation's homeless individuals.
Also, you'll meet Walt Lafke, co-founder of the successful student startup Harvestly.
It's all this giant local ecosystem that we've started to stimulate, which, at least in the food system, has been really hard to stimulate and to create just because the infrastructure hasn't been there.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, September 27th, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. Last week on our series, Beyond the Furrows, about farm workers on the Central Coast, we introduced you to Francis Salvador, a farm worker in Santa Maria, motivated by her family and her desire to one day return home to Mexico. This week, KCBX's Francisco Martinez introduces you to Reina Mendoza, a farm worker who has spent much of her life giving back to her kids and to her community.
Reina Mendoza is 50 years old and has been in the United States for the last 21 years. She's called Santa Maria home for the last 9 years. Mendoza is a single mother with 5 children, 4 boys in their early to mid-20s, and 1 teenage daughter. But life as a farm worker, Mendoza says, made it initially difficult to enjoy motherhood.
Antes renegaba y no sabía por qué.
Tal vez she says she complained, but she didn't know why she did it. It may have been pain she dealt with internally and being frustrated having her 5 kids, she says, on top of working hard in the strawberry fields. She says that while she was always on the run, it made her change a lot and that it was worth it. Mendoza says she later realized that she needed to value and appreciate life in its duality, the beauty of it, and the suffering that comes along with it.
Busca la manera de levantarte en la mañana, aunque te sientas mal, aunque te sientas...
She says that you have to get up in the morning for those kids. Even if you might feel bad or if you can't do it anymore, she says you look for a way to get up in the morning. Mendoza says it's her love for her children that motivates her. She says it's not a sacrifice because parents do things out of love for their kids. Mendoza says she did a lot of things for her kids when they were younger, volunteering at their school, assisting school nurses, or attending school parent meetings. As the years go by, she says she learned a lot and that she loved to be involved with the community. Mendoza says, however, that being a mother didn't allow her the chance to focus on her own personal growth. That changed after she was invited to a meeting organized by the Central Coast Alliance United for a Sustainable Economy, or CAUSE. She says that, through attending CAUSE's meetings, she learned about her rights as a farm worker and realized the information CAUSE shared at its meetings is very important. After attending the meeting, Mendoza says she asked herself, why not get involved? That way, she says, she can learn to defend her rights as a farm worker. Mendoza says farm workers are treated poorly by bosses who shout at them. She says it doesn't have to be that way. So she did get involved. Some of her volunteer efforts include distributing masks and food during the pandemic, assisting in vaccine information campaigns, participating in meetings for community organizations, and sharing what she learns with others. Zulema Aleman, a community organizer with CAUSE, says Mendoza was one of the first people she met when she started her job at CAUSE 2.5 years ago. Aleman praised Mendoza for being invested in self-growth, something Aleman says not many people can do when raised in environments where emotion processing is discouraged.
That's not something that I think a lot of us grew up with, and to see her be that mom and then see her advocate for the community in different ways, I think it's a really cool experience.
Mendoza says bringing positive change through her community involvement matters because many people in the community might not know about their rights as farm workers or resources available to them. She says other farm workers come over to her house to get brochures and information pamphlets. Sharing this knowledge is fulfilling to her, she says.
Es algo que te está motivando.
Mendoza says that kind of work is motivating. She says that on top of being busy, you get to give back to the city and the community.
Estás portando para la comunidad.
Mendoza's efforts to bring positive change to the community line up with her philosophy about change. She says change is something everyone has to go through in their lives. Not just for themselves or their families, but for the community as well.
Para bien, he tratado de cambiarle.
Mendoza says she's tried to change for the better and that many people need to give change a chance as they have the opportunity to learn. She says it's never too late to learn. Mendoza says she didn't always have this approach to life. She says she didn't learn much in her youth because of how busy she was with her farm work and her family. She says she didn't have a life before, but now she does, and says it's because of her kids. She says her kids support her in whatever she wants, and that having the support of your children is a beautiful thing to feel. Next week, you'll get to meet Maria. She's a farm worker who hasn't been able to find any work since last year, and she'll tell you her story about her life in the United States. For KCBX News, I'm Francisco Martinez.
This episode of Beyond the Furrows is made possible by a grant from the Sunflower Foundation. We have a new feature on Issues and Ideas, Agenda Breakdown with Kim Bischoff.
Welcome to the first episode of Agenda Breakdown, a podcast that explores how cities make decisions and how you can have a say. In each episode, we'll interview an expert about one policy issue that's making its way through local government. Then you'll find out exactly how to make your voice heard. I'm Kim Bischoff, and today we're going to talk about what happens when the mayor resigns. On August 27th, San Luis Obispo Mayor Heidi Harmon made a surprising announcement. She would step down the following month, even though there was more than a year left in her term. Harmon had served as mayor since 2016. She left that role on September 21st to take a climate advocacy job with a nonprofit in Santa Cruz. Today, we're going to talk with Teresa Purrington, the city clerk in San Luis Obispo, about what happens next. How will San Luis Obispo fill the city council vacancy left by Mayor Harmon's early departure? Welcome, Teresa. Thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
So as city clerk, you work inside City Hall, and part of your job is going to city council meetings. What do you do with those meetings?
So my job in the city council meeting is to take the minutes and generally ensure that the meeting runs smoothly.
Were you at the meeting on September 7th, a little over a week after Mayor Harmon made her announcement?
Yes, I was.
And what happened during that meeting?
So the council had the opportunity to vote to make an appointment to fill the vacancy or to hold a special election to fill the vacancy.
And what factors were they considering when they made that decision?
Time, cost, the complexity, and for not only us, but also for any candidate running.
My assumption then is that it takes more time and it costs more and it's more complex to go through an election process than an appointment process. Is that correct?
Yeah, an election process has to take anywhere from 90 to 150 days.
Okay. And so what did they ultimately decide?
They decided to go the route of making an appointment. But if they can't make an appointment for whatever reason, within 30 days of the vacancy, then they will have to do a special election.
So the immediate goal is to appoint someone to replace the mayor vacancy. Will they also make an appointment to replace the missing council member if that mayor vacancy is filled by an existing council member?
Yes, an existing council member can apply for the mayor's vacancy. And in the event that they do, that would create a vacancy in their council member seat. So we would have to fill two seats in a sense in that instance.
Is there any indication that that's what's likely to happen?
There's been talk, but you know whether or not they actually do, we don't know until the deadline.
Okay. So community members had until September 24th to apply for the open position. That's only 2.5 weeks. Who was allowed to apply? What are the requirements?
So to apply for the vacancy, you must be a resident of the city of San Luis Obispo 30 days prior to the appointment. You must be a registered voter in the city of San Luis Obispo. You have to complete an application, submit a resume, and a 500-word or less statement covering why you wanted to be on council, the amount of time you have available for council, what involvement you've had in the community or organizations in the last 23-month period, and any prior experience you have working in government, working with the government, or doing business with government.
So how many people went through that process?
So as of right now, we've received 13 applications. However, we've not had the opportunity yet to verify those. That will happen on September 27th.
So it's the city clerk's responsibility to make sure that, for instance, they are registered voters and they've lived in San Luis Obispo for 30 days, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And as far as the whether they've been a resident for 30 days, that's a little harder to we don't actually verify that. We take their word. But the registered voter, we do make sure that they are registered with the county registrar of voters.
So usually when the city council is planning to vote on an issue, that meeting's agenda will include a staff report with a staff recommendation. Is that the case this time? Is the staff going to weigh in?
Not on the applicants. We will provide a recommendation with regard to the process so that we can run a smooth meeting. But as far as the applicants are concerned, no, it's just a list of who applied and here's the information they submitted.
And will that information be published prior to the October 5th meeting?
Yes, it's actually going to be published on September 28th, along with the council agenda for that meeting, the staff report, which we call a council agenda report, just in case it's confusing. And then, of course, all of the applications and all backup information that was submitted by each applicant.
And what will happen on October 5th? What will that meeting look like?
So right now, the suggested process is that all applicants will be provided 5 minutes to make a presentation to council. We will then consider filling the vacant council member position.
So they will first decide if they're going to fill the mayor slot internally. And if that is the case, then they will look to this pool of applicants and decide how to fill that spot. Will both of those individuals be sworn in on the spot, or will that happen at a later meeting?
No, because this is a unique situation, we will swear them in at the meeting. And one point of clarification is that the application process does have the applicants indicate whether they are interested in the mayor position or the council member or both.
Thank you. That's important to know. And now for the most important part of our show, where we tell our listeners how to make their voice heard, the action item. Teresa, what's one specific step listeners can take if they want to weigh in on our next mayor and council member?
So they can provide public comment. And we offer many ways for the public to provide public comment on this item and on any item on any council agenda. The best way to do that is to either send an email, a letter, a voicemail to city council. And all of the information on how to do that is listed on the cover of every agenda.
Thanks so much, Teresa. I really appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
Okay, so here's your action item. September 28th is when these applications will be made public. Go ahead and read through them and share your thoughts with City Council through email, voicemail, or public comment. You can find a link to the City Council agenda on the city's website. We'll also post it on our Instagram at Agenda Breakdown. This episode was produced by Francisco Martinez with original music by Wes Bischoff. Huge thanks to Patty Pyburn and Marisa Waddell for editing help and general awesomeness. That's all for now. Have a great week.
Agenda Breakdown with Kim Bischoff will be an occasional feature of Issues and Ideas. Here at KCBX, we like to work with local students to give them an opportunity to air their work and to bring you some fresh new voices. Up next, students Ashley Rush and Daniel Wasius from KCSB Radio at UC Santa Barbara.
Santa Barbara County is currently seeing an increase in wildlife activity in urban and residential areas. The Santa Barbara Wildlife Care Network, a nonprofit aiming to rescue, rehabilitate, and return sick and injured wildlife to their habitats here in Santa Barbara County, seeks to educate the public about living in harmony with wildlife. KCSB's Danielle Wasia speaks with SBWCN Director of Operations Julia Parker and SBWCN Communications Manager to discuss what to do if you ever encounter wildlife in your area. Danielle begins by asking Julia Parker about the reason for the increase in wildlife activity.
Santa Barbara County is currently seeing an increase of wildlife activity in residential areas. What factors are contributing to this increase that we're currently seeing?
I think some of it might be carryover from all the fires that we've had recently and animals having to relocate, find new territories, moving west from the last fires that we had in, you know, starting in Santa Paula and Ventura. Once those areas become denuded, they have to look for areas that can, you know, support them, support their survival with the food source and shelter. They're basically destroying habitats for humans temporarily and for wildlife for, you know, an unknown period of time. It's going to take a long time for those places to, you know, regenerate, get new plant growth, have animals move back in. They just have to seek other areas if they survive the fire, that is.
From what I understand, the animals community members are encountering the most are bears, rattlesnakes, and specifically coyotes. Is there any reason in particular for this?
Rattlesnakes have probably been there all along. And when people spend more time outside, you know, they're going to have more wildlife encounters. If you have a shed or a wood pile in your backyard or a food source, you're going to be inviting wildlife, especially at the end of the summer when it gets hotter and, you know, maybe creeks dry up. Bears are going to seek out water. And, you know, you've seen many pictures on the news of bears enjoying somebody's backyard swimming pool. They're just looking for opportunities to cool off and get some water as well. So it's not unlikely, just like in the beginning of the springtime, I always tell people, if you have a swimming pool in your backyard, it's quite likely you're going to have a family of mallard ducklings just pop up into your swimming pool. Because a lot of times people don't even notice the wildlife are there.
And you'd mentioned rattlesnakes. Now, rattlesnakes pose a unique threat to community members, specifically because they're venomous.
The best advice I can say is to call County Animal Services, and they will relocate the animal out of your yard. Not very far, however, because it is a California Fish and Wildlife regulation that we cannot relocate wildlife. Relocating them can be a death sentence because you're taking them out of their habitat. They know where the food and water sources are, their shelter. They may have a nest with offspring. We have had numerous calls of rattlesnakes in people's yards, and they have small dogs and young children. And of course, they don't want that danger, you know, for their family. So animal control or animal services does help us in relocating those animals across the street, you know, because a lot of these calls, people are living, you know, I always ask them what area they live in, and they have a creek in their backyard or nearby. So, you know, there you go. That's, you're in wildlife habitat. Also, you have to remember that in our neighborhoods, we have raccoons, skunks, possums, and squirrels, and they've adapted to be able to live in close proximity to humans.
Are there any other tips or pieces of advice that you would offer to community members to continue to reduce their chances of these encounters?
I think big ones that apply to so many different species and helping keep them out of your backyards is, you know, removing food, shelter, and water sources. So making sure your pet food is inside overnight, making sure your pets are inside or secured. Animals will take up shelter in wood piles and under sheds. And like we've been saying, they're opportunistic. So those are all little things that can actually help keep wildlife out of your backyard, wildlife of all different species.
And by chance, if a community member were to encounter specifically the animals that pose more of a threat to their safety, such as rattlesnakes, coyotes, and bears, what can they do to avoid harm in that encounter?
I think generally speaking, it's better to be calm, no quick movement, make sure you have your pets or children nearby and close to you, no sudden movements, back away slowly, don't turn your back and run, especially for mountain lions or coyotes, making yourself big, making yourself a presence. Making some noise might help deter them, but backing away slowly is usually enough. These animals usually don't want anything to do with us either and are just trying to go on their own way as well.
You know, a lot of the line of questioning has been specifically in centering the community member. However, I do want to ask, what can community members do to keep the wildlife safe?
Our website, by the way, is a great place to view resources like this, like answers to frequently asked questions, tips to help wildlife, what to do if you encounter wildlife of different species. So our website or our helpline is always available for the public to call to find out more information.
some good tips, especially with the animals we were talking about, are keeping your dogs on a leash. Not only does that protect your dogs, but we get a lot of animals every year that are victims of being caught by dogs. That's birds, that's baby bunnies even. So keeping your dog on a leash is always a really great thing to do, especially when you're out, you know, on a trail or hiking or on the beach. Avoiding using rat poison as a form of rodent control is really important, because although your intended victims might be rodents, a lot of other wildlife can be affected and killed by rodenticide. So an owl who eats a poisoned rat, or, you know, a fox or a mountain lion, all of these animals could be harmed or killed by rat poison. So we really encourage people to avoid using rat poison or glue traps or snap traps for that matter, because it can affect a lot of different animals in the food chain. And then feeding animals is generally a bad idea. We like to ask people to avoid feeding animals. Not only could it, you know, be problematic with them attaching food to humans, but it could be bad for their health as well. So we'd encourage people to avoid feeding wild animals as much as possible. Julia, are there any others? Any big ones I missed?
I wanted to mention, you know, there are for the smaller animals that we live with, there are some beneficial aspects to having them in your area. For instance, you know, they are going to consume the rodents that you might otherwise feel like you need to poison. And so raccoons and possums and skunks do eat rodents and, you know, rats, mice, squirrels, bunnies. And so they're kind of, it kind of balances out. There can be a win-win. When people do put out poison, if it doesn't kill the secondary host, it can weaken them to the point where their immune system is compromised. And that's why we've been seeing, I think, so many coyotes with mange, because that is one of the results of a weakened immune system, and it allows parasites to take over and cause them to become emaciated, dehydrated. And if mange isn't treated, it can kill them. And it's also contagious to your pets. So keeping wildlife healthy can also help keep your pets healthy.
I want to take a moment to discuss currently what the Wildlife Care Network is doing and what plans you have for the future.
Last year, we actually saw more animals come to our center than ever before. We treated over 4,500 patients, and we're definitely on track to do that again this year. We're receiving wildlife every day that's in need of help, mostly due to human-related causes, like some of the things we talked about: animals that are caught by dogs or cats, animals that are poisoned, animals that are hit by cars, animals whose nests have been cut down through tree trimming. Most of the animals we see are in our care because of human-related causes. On the flip side of that, most of our patients are being brought in by citizens. So our community is finding these animals and realizing they need help and calling us and giving these animals a second chance to really continue living their life in our backyard. These are our wild neighbors, so we're lucky to have a community that actually is looking out for them as well. We're also really lucky to have an incredible volunteer support system. We're a nonprofit, so we rely on donations from our community, the help of our community, and our volunteers are a really big part of that. With that, we've been around for over 30 years, and we are finally constructing our wildlife hospital that will really enhance all of our resources and facilities and give us the upgrades to care for even more animals and give them even better care than they're receiving now. So that should be completed by the end of the year, and we're really excited to see that happen.
The Santa Barbara Wildlife Care Network is open 365 days a year to the public. Additionally, a helpline is available to the community from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. every day at 805-681-1080. Again, that's 805-681-1080. Resources and answers to frequently answered questions can be found on the network's website at sbwcn.org. That's sbwcn.org. Thank you again to Lauren Gonzalez, SBWCN Communications Manager, and Julia Parker, SBWCN Director of Operations.
That was Ashley Rush and Daniel Wasius as part of KCBX's partnership with UC Santa Barbara's KCSB. It's time now for the nonprofit story.
I'm your host, Dr. Consuelo Mukes. Today, I have Jill Bolster-White. She is the Executive Director of Transitions Mental Health Association. This organization eliminates stigma and promoting recovery and wellness for people with mental health illnesses through work, housing, community, and family resources, something we need to hear about today, a very timely message. Jill, welcome to the Nonprofit Story.
Thank you so much for inviting me. And thanks for mentioning our mission. And that is really the sort of focus that we want to have is on community mental health. And community mental health has been elevated by COVID. And so it really aligns very closely with what we do at Transitions Mental Health Association. We focus on the whole person. So a lot of the work we do is helping people who have a diagnosis of a severe or persistent mental illness. So maybe they have a diagnosis of clinical depression, of schizophrenia, post-traumatic stress, bipolar disorder. So those diagnoses are the focus of our clinical work. So we have a couple of intensive residential treatment programs, some very intensive outpatient services for folks. And then we really try to wrap around all the other kinds of things people need. Housing, employment. We run a couple of social enterprises. We have Growing Grounds Farm and Nursery. We also have really learned that this journey is a parallel journey for family members. So if somebody, let's say, has an onset of a mental illness when they're maybe 19 years old, maybe a freshman in college, or maybe in the military, the whole family is going to have an impact on that. And so we do try to help provide that support and navigation for family members. We have a crisis hotline that operates 24/7. Anytime someone has a question, maybe if they're in crisis, or even for people who are contemplating suicide. Uh-huh. So we really try to do everything we can in Northern Santa Barbara County and throughout San Luis Obispo County to make sure people with a mental health diagnosis can get access to support and services.
So you have a broad range of services, Jill, and tell us, what is the need in both of our counties? Are you seeing it grow? What is the need for mental health services?
I would say that the need has grown partially because of COVID, and then partially because I think people are understanding the need for mental health services. There's so much data out right now about the impact to like our kids who, you know, maybe were away from school for a year and a half. I haven't met a parent who has a school-age child yet who hasn't just acknowledged how important it is for our kids to be in school, to be connected with friends, with professional educators, rather than, you know, their parents who aren't always qualified or really able. So, and the need, I think, has grown with homelessness. We've definitely seen the issue of homelessness in all of the communities that we serve. And as you well know, I think the statistic I just read is that California now is thought to have 50% of the nation's homeless individuals in our state alone.
That's amazing.
We need therapists. We need good psychiatric access. We need primary care providers. So if I bring my kids into a pediatrician or I go see my internist, ideally they can help identify some of those mental health needs and then really find the local resources so people can access.
You're seeing students and young children and some of the mental health issues that they face because of being sheltered in and not around people as they should, especially as they're growing, and even adults, I'm sure.
That's right. And even people who haven't experienced a mental health condition. I know we've lots of friends. Certainly, I felt a much higher level of anxiety and concern. And I think that's definitely because of just elevated isolation, elevated concern about the impacts of COVID and how to keep you know, my family safe, our staff here at TEMA safe. So I think that's really true as people are trying to navigate those decisions. I know we're talking about the vaccines and do people need a third booster and, you know, how much masking do we need to do to stay safe? And so there's just a lot of concern out in the community right now. And as I said, I think the good news is it makes us aware of mental health. And the harder news is helping people access the right level of service.
Something that you're doing, and I think it touches on an issue a lot of us are hearing about and concerned about, you're doing a multi-county suicide prevention summit. It's something like you're aware of. Tell us about this summit.
So the summit is a multi-county, as you said. We partnered very closely with both county behavioral health departments, San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara counties of behavioral departments of behavioral wellness. It is going to be September 30th from 9 to 3, and people can get more information on our website. But the focus on suicide prevention is really just to talk openly. There's a lot of stigma around even bringing up suicide, even how you might address it if there's a person that you have some concerns that maybe they're contemplating suicide. I recently talked to a friend who was worried about another friend, and the question was, do I even bring it up? I'm concerned that this person is showing signs of maybe contemplating suicide. And do I bring it up? Do I ignore it? Do I, you know, what do people do? And we have a slightly higher suicide rate here in San Luis Obispo County.
Really?
The statewide average. It's about 3 to 4% higher. We want to really try to stop that contemplation and give people options. So the Suicide Prevention Forum is going to be done virtually. And so we have some great speakers. In fact, we've got a really interesting woman who I think is going to be very compelling. She talks about her own experience, her own contemplation. She comes actually as a woman of color and talking about that element of her experience. And I think some of the ways that I've learned the most about suicide and the steps that are contemplated really have come from some of these prevention forums. So I really encourage people to find out more and to sign up. And it's on our website, t-mha.org.
And also, do you have any type of a hotline?
Our Central Coast hotline has been in place actually since 1970. It was the SLOW hotline, and then it's been part of TEMA now for 11 years. 800-783-0607. And it is staffed by volunteers and paid staff who go through extensive training to ask people about whether they're contemplating suicide, to help someone who may be feeling that they're in crisis, to maybe link them to county crisis services, or to answer questions. So sometimes we'll get a call from someone who's curious about, you know, how do I respond to this? Or I'm suspicious that this woman I work with or a man I work with is exhibiting signs of mental illness. Where can I go to find out more? Our hotline takes a myriad calls, all connected to mental health services. Like I said, for people in crisis, really contemplating their next steps, possibly suicide, to people who have questions and want to know more about resources. 24/7, 365 days a year.
If you are just joining us, this is The Nonprofit Story. I'm your host, Dr. Consuelo Mukes, and I'm speaking with the Executive Director of Transitions Mental Health Association, Jill Bolster White. Jill, you're working with housing and family support and work support and other community programs and clinical services, homeless services, forensic services. Just if you can touch on a couple of these and tell us what type of services are available and who's being served.
You know, we talk a lot about best practices, and I think one of the things that's really happening around the country is looking at law enforcement and their interaction with folks. How do we train law enforcement so that their interactions with people, everyone in the community, really are matching the need? And on the mental health side, really the best practice now is to pair social workers and outreach workers with police officers and sheriff's deputies. Mm-hmm. And so I'm proud that the city of San Luis Obispo was the first jurisdiction to do that. The sheriff's department also has mental health workers. So that's, I think, a really important best practice. So whether it's a domestic violence call, even in response to maybe a hate crime, but certainly lots of connections with people who are unhoused, it's really been helpful to have someone who's trained in de-escalation, who's not wearing a uniform, who's not wearing a gun, doesn't have that presence that law enforcement folks have just by the way that they're dressed and the way that they are comporting themselves. That's made a big difference. There are models out of Oregon that have shown how helpful that is in de-escalating and really getting people not to jail necessarily, but maybe directed to mental health or substance use services. And then how do we really say what's the most appropriate, humane, and connected way we can help folks who may be living on the streets because of an untreated diagnosis? So those are all things we're very involved with and try to support as an organization and providing services or as advocates to make sure that our elected officials and people who are in decision-making roles understand what those best practices are.
How does someone connect with TEMA to get the services?
As you can imagine, we get lots of calls about housing because housing is so expensive for all of us. 75% of our services are really paid for and accessible by people who are in the county behavioral health system. So if somebody approaches the county behavioral health system, either in Santa Barbara or San Luis Obispo, they're likely to be assessed there and then referred to our permanent supported housing program or our residential treatment program. Now, the different services, we talked about the hotline. Our family services program is open to anyone in the community who has a loved one who has a mental health condition. We have 5 wellness centers, Atascadero, San Luis Obispo, Arroyo Grande, Santa Maria, and Lompoc. Those are open to anyone who, again, self-identifies as having a mental health condition and wanting to learn more about resources and support and to connect. So those are all available to folks, and those can be accessed through our website and calling our offices. And the hotline staff can also help direct people to services, whether they're TEMA services or maybe Community Counseling Center, Family Care Network, CAPSLO, one of our partner organizations. That may be an appropriate referral. So unfortunately, the answer is it depends, but definitely calling our office or calling the hotline is a good way to get started.
Well, now, can these services remain confidential?
Any service that someone gets here at TEMA, particularly if it's a mental health service and moves into that realm, is confidential. We're definitely bound by all the HIPAA restrictions that really protect people's confidentiality. We did a really interesting study about how hard it is for people to talk to even their primary care doctor about their mental health concerns. And so confidentiality is so, so important. And so
we're
under the same obligation as a physician is. And so the hotline is all entirely confidential.
Now, this is just a hypothetical, but say you're in the workplace, you're the head of an organization, or you're a worker sitting next to someone, and you do think that maybe that person would have an issue that they're able to recognize. What would be the best steps for that person to do?
I think depending on the relationship with the person, I know when we did a stigma reduction campaign years ago, one of the people that we talked to and we featured in our documentary said that he actually had exactly the scenario you're describing. He approached his boss to say, I'm worried about my work here. And she said, I actually think you would benefit from mental health treatment. So it's a little different than the scenario you pose, but I was really impressed that an employer would have the presence of mind and the empathy to recognize that that was a person, A, worth, you know, giving the time and the space and latitude to seek out mental health care and treatment. But if you just are, you know, in the workplace and you have that suspicion, it's, I think it can be really helpful and empathetic to start a conversation with that person to say, I'm worried about you. I'm concerned, you know, that you may be depressed or that you may have this situation or you seem very anxious. And I think to really just come at it from an empathetic perspective. I know I've been really heartened to hear a couple of examples from family members who said that teachers or in some cases college professors called the parents to say, I'm worried about your child. And I really, and so I think in those cases, they went directly to the student, but then really thought, I actually would like to reach out to their parents. Because they need to know that their adult child needs help. So I think
that's great.
I thought that those were great examples. I think
yes.
What I want to say is reach out, try not to be intimidated by the conversation. Try to feel like you can reach out and ask questions and can handle giving somebody access. Maybe you would mention the hotline number to somebody that you would see as maybe having some mental health symptoms. So there are lots of ways, I think, of reaching out personally, offering the hotline number, offering, you know, maybe recommending a therapist. Community mm-hmm. Counseling Center provides sliding scale therapy, a really wonderful and amazing resource. So that's another resource. So really trying to give somebody a bridge to think that if somebody understands and acknowledges that they might be going through a painful period.
Are there any costs associated with services?
Actually, the family services, the hotline, the wellness centers are all free.
Wonderful.
So those services are free. The people who live in our housing pay about 30% of their income towards rent. Mm-hmm. And so, but our services are all primarily paid for by our county contracts or by local donations and philanthropic support.
It's so many programs. I mean, 40 programs, I guess there are, according to your website. That's amazing, the work you do and the amount of outreach you make to this community. So I hope people will be supportive. And you do have your Suicide Prevention Summit coming up. We want people to know about that. And your Trunks of Treasure event, is that right?
That's right.
The annual event.
Trunks of Treasure. It's really fun. People can buy a key, and 10 of the keys will open a wonderful prize, including a week in Cabo San Lucas and all sorts of great Central Coast kinds of amazing prizes.
Jill, give us one more time the number of the hotline.
So our hotline number is 800-783-0607. And I encourage people to put it in their smartphones, and that way you have it just in case you need it or you encounter someone, as we talked about, who you think may benefit from it. If it's in your phone, you can easily just forward that contact to someone or read it or even call the hotline right then and there if you encounter somebody in crisis.
This has been Jill Bolster-White. She is the Executive Director of Transitions Mental Health Association. This is the nonprofit story.
That was Dr. Consuelo Mukes. The Multi-County Suicide Prevention Summit is this Thursday, September 30th. Learn more at t-mha.org. And now, Working Lunch.
Welcome to Working Lunch, a Slo Chambers weekly series where we talk with our community leaders to get to know the person behind the position and all the interesting things they're working on. I'm Jim D'Antona, President and CEO of the San Luis Chamber, and today you'll get to hear from Walt Lafke, our founder and CEO of Harvestly Company. This Cal Poly startup delivers local farm-fresh produce, prepared food, and beverages to your door. After just over a year in business, centered around health, sustainability, and the local economy, Harvestly aims to change the current food system, empower other businesses, and bring sustainability to food systems globally. I'm so looking forward to learning more about Walt's inspiration, what it's been like to balance starting a company, working for NASDAQ, and finishing up college. Walt, thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Jim. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk about Harvestly.
It's such a pleasure. Maybe tell us a little bit about how you got your start in entrepreneurship. Have you always been interested in technology and problem solving?
Yeah, so I really started working in entrepreneurship when I was about 14 years old. My parents had a property in Northern Oregon that I started a little tomato farm on. I bought $50 worth of tomato seeds and started watering these plants over the course of a summer when I was 14 years old. And from there, I just started growing that business. And I stopped about 3 years later. And at the end of it, I was delivering about 1,000 pounds of tomatoes every week. And kind of from there, entrepreneurship has always felt accessible to me and like I could always do it. So I just kept pursuing that throughout high school and then also, as you know, in college.
Not many people can obviously say that the company they started in college is just the most recent in a long line of enterprises. Can you take us through some of your thought process on what interested you there and how it led you to Harvestly?
really from the beginning when I started growing these tomatoes and this food, when I was 14, I developed this passion for really good food and then helping the customer understand where that food was from. At the time when I was 14, I didn't really know anything about marketing or business, but I knew how to grow good food. And so with the product in mind, it really spoke for itself and it grew a brand. It was called Wally's Tomatoes. And still to this day, when I go back to Bend, people ask me about Wally's Tomatoes, like, where are the tomatoes? So it really developed a brand around that really good product. And kind of as I grew up, I started to see other issues in the kind of broader agriculture system where consolidation was happening. And really a lot of the food that you eat, one, you don't know where it's coming from, but two, it's supplied by some of the same companies that are controlling most of the industry. And, you know, they're really good at marketing. They're really good at selling to you. They're good at making it efficient. But the product necessarily isn't the best. And I thought, you know, how can I help other farmers market their products, get their products to the consumer without having them, you know, have to market too much. And it was really just trying to help them get their really great product to the consumer and helping the consumer understand where that product is from.
Harvestly has grown beyond just produce, right? Was that a purposeful strategy or kind of a more of a response to the market?
Yeah, to be totally honest, I did not expect it to go beyond produce. When I started it, it was actually called AgriConnect. So it was all about agriculture and getting, you know, food to consumers through this network. And it really surprised me because we launched during the pandemic, like really the first week that Slow shut down. And week after week, we had new verticals signing up. And like, we didn't necessarily do this on purpose. They kind of came to us. And at a certain point, probably about 6 months ago, we realized like, hey, you know, you can source almost everything you need locally. So let's get after that. Like, let's continue to build this vendor base so that any local consumer in San Luis Obispo can, or in San Luis Obispo County, can go on to our website and order really anything they need, and they can survive off of purely local food. It was really great to see these different verticals sign up, and it has propelled the business really far. You know, if we would have just stuck with produce, it would have worked, but I don't think it would have grown to the extent that it has now.
I think we said in the start, it's like a digital farmer's market 24/7. Is that kind of how it feels at this point?
Yeah, and that's definitely the easiest way to explain it. There are a lot of different complicated things going on behind the scenes, and we're really trying to empower these local businesses. Our hypothesis is if we empower these local businesses to sell, the consumer will ultimately benefit because we're helping these businesses get their product to the consumer. We're very vendor focused, so we're trying to help them the most, but by helping them, it helps the customer. And so over time, it's just been this development of the original project, which was this kind of decentralized marketplace where everybody had equal opportunity to sell and all of these different things. And it ends up that the customer really likes that. They really like the customization. They like to pick and choose. And if we have the infrastructure set up to, you know, handle the food, deliver the food and all of that, then why not get everything we can on the platform?
Local farmers, producers, and artisans can apply to be featured on your site, but there has to have been some like strange ones. What's the kind of the most unusual pitch you've received or application?
Yeah, I think about 5 weeks ago, we got an application that was for worms. You know, we had to deny that one just because of we were a little nervous to put the worms in the bags with the food. But yeah, we get quite a few applications, and it's really unique. You know, there's some products on Harvestly, I swear, you cannot find anywhere else. So it is really unique in that sense.
You launched the business in the early days of that pandemic. What was that launch like, or the first few months like? Did it all go to plan, or were you constantly adjusting?
I never wrote a business plan. It's always been about adjusting and forming to the market. I think about kind of the company as somewhat of a river, and we're always trying to go downstream and follow where the customers and where the vendors are taking us. And early on, I got two farms on. It was Gracious Greens in Arroyo Grande, and then also Pepper Creek Family Farms in Arroyo Grande. And Alvin runs Gracious Greens and Jessica runs Pepper Creek Family Farms. I became really close with them. And I really pitched them on my vision and to help them. And they kind of bought in and they were like, all right, let's do it. And so I got them on the app and had a few products on there. It was just microgreens and like three different types of produce boxes. And I got 10 users on the customer side. And we just started taking orders, like, you know, probably 10 a week. And I had no like money to fund this. And, you know, it's hard to get someone to invest in a 19-year-old's vision for a new food system. So I was just driving around in my Jeep, fulfilling these orders, going, you know, as soon as we would get an order, I would drive straight to the farm down in AG, pick up the box and drive it straight to the customer. And the customer was always like, wow, this came in like 30 minutes. I have never experienced anything like this. But kind of over time, we have had to adjust to actual scalable solutions that, you know, me driving around in my Jeep throughout the county is not scalable.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. The Slow Chamber's Jim D'Antona is speaking with Walt Lafke, the co-founder of the student startup Harvestly.
In the midst of the pandemic, you're launching Harvestly, you're building this company up. You're finishing up your junior year at Cal Poly. You're also working at NASDAQ, right?
Yeah, so I started working at NASDAQ when I was a freshman out of the San Francisco office. And I started in this corporate sales platform. So I was, you know, helping NASDAQ's public companies kind of I like to say be public. So obviously with going public, you have a lot of different things you have to worry about. So I would help them and work on that team in San Francisco. And over time, I just kind of transformed into new roles. And ultimately, my kind of latest job was helping private companies work with public companies and forming relationships and partnerships there. And 100%, it helped me create this company that I have now. It really gave me the confidence and a lot of the knowledge to run the company, right? It's great that I started a tomato company and sold a bunch of tomatoes, but that's about as a simple business as you can get. And as you add complexity, there's more things going on. And so like people management, you know, learning how to work with people, strategy, marketing, all these things that I didn't know about through NASDAQ, I've been able to learn a lot in that sense.
You know, it's been 1 year for Harvestly and you've injected more than $200,000 directly into the hands of local producers. How does your hyper kind of local focus create that even larger ripple effect?
I don't really think that any business model works on the same way in comparison to ours for these local vendors, in that like majority of the funds that we generate are going right back into our economy. And these are everyday people running their businesses. It's not big businesses. All of them are pretty much very small businesses, and they're going straight to the people who run the business. They're going to the families who run the businesses. A lot of them are family run. And so what happens is, you know, they get the dollars and they're going to go spend those dollars somewhere else. And it's all this giant local ecosystem that we've started to stimulate, which at least in the food system has been really hard to stimulate and to create just because the infrastructure hasn't been there. If you go to a grocery store, great, you go to a local grocery store and there's, you know, maybe there's some local products, but at the end of the day, the typical grocery store model does not return enough dollars to the local producer or any producer, because every single step of the way, someone needs to make a margin. So if we can create this one transition model where it's going straight from the vendor to the consumer, we can cut out a lot of those little margins so we can return a lot more to the producer.
In the economic discussion of speed of money, as that money that's getting produced here is staying in here and circulating, is just growing more and more jobs. I think it's really a fascinating discussion and something that I think COVID has really shown us we need to do to keep our local economy going. Do you think launching the pandemic when many people were forced to try out new endeavors has helped hone that focus?
Yeah. I really think that the pandemic gave us a huge opportunity to support these businesses, and it kind of across the board in all sectors, it was a catalyst to open-mindedness, I guess, thinking about projects differently. A lot of people who would have thought that Harvestly was a bad idea said, oh, maybe that is a good idea because of these supply chain issues that have really been brought out during the pandemic. I like to talk about how the problems in the supply chain in agriculture have been present for, you know, at least a couple of decades, but the pandemic really put a magnifying glass under the system and then it broke. So a lot of people say, oh, you know, you came up with this solution because of the pandemic, but that's not true. I knew at some point these systems would start to break and the consumer would want change. But the pandemic was really just a catalyst to create that change. And so on the vendor side, it was really good for us because they started thinking about things differently.
And from your experience that you talked about with the tomatoes as a young man, you know, you talked about helping get some of your local vendors kind of launched. What does it look like to be a Harvestly launch partner? Are you guys there just kind of every step of the way with them helping?
Yeah, and that's been a huge goal of ours. And we've really started to lean into this in that we are helping businesses start. So it's a lot of people. I forget the statistic, but, you know, majority of people want to start their own business, but they just have no idea how to. And, you know, it can be as simple as planting 50 tomato plants in your backyard and selling tomatoes. It's just that the barriers are so large with understanding. It's like this gap of knowledge. How do you, you know, get the permit? How do you get the insurance? How do you get a bank? There's all these blockers that we want to take away. We want to help you handle that. And so what we've seen, at least since kind of leaning into this, is that a lot of people have started businesses with Harvestly. An example is, I don't think she's selling on Harvestly right now, but Ellery's zucchini bread. She was 13 or 14. She sent me an email and was applying to be a vendor, and she didn't have any permits or anything. And I emailed her back and I was like, hey, we would love to help you, you know, start your business. Here's how you do it, step by step. And about a month later, or maybe 2 months later, she emailed me back and was like, oh, here's my cottage license. Here's this. Like, she's a real business. And now she's selling like throughout the local county, her zucchini bread, and she's 14 years old. So that was a really cool experience for me. And I think, you know, that happens probably every 2 months or every month for us.
The barriers are sometimes folks just don't know how to get past them. And so having the experience that you do, and that's obviously what we do here at the Chamber, is to try and help folks get over, whether it's the city, the county, the state, whoever you're working with, you're launching these folks into their dream that, you know, you helped create for yourself, right?
Yeah, totally. It's just balance between purpose and profit. And we think that these people really have a purpose in growing or making food, which we want to enable and empower.
Well, I know that when I first arrived in SLO, I was blown away by the quality of the local produce compared to the grocery store stuff I was getting in LA. Do most of your customers come to you already knowing the advantages of buying local, or do you have an educational aspect to Harvestly to make that connection?
Yeah. So historically, a lot of them have come to Harvestly because they know the value of local. And I will say that as far as educated about local food, SLO County ranks pretty high because we have a lot of food grown here. You can't go on a 15-minute drive and not see a farm in SLO County. And so, you know, we had an advantage there when we launched because a lot of people already kind of knew the value of it. But as we expand into new markets and also kind of increase our density of customers here in SLO, it is moving more towards an educational purpose. Like, what are the benefits of supporting local? And, you know, how can you support local? And what is the value in the food sense? Like, how much more nutrition does a tomato grown a mile from you have versus a tomato grown in Mexico that has spent 3 weeks on a truck? So working on that educational piece is going to be part of our next evolution.
Thank you so much for joining us today and talking about Harvestly.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
That was the SLO Chamber's Jim D'Antona speaking with Walt Lafke, the co-founder of the student startup Harvestly. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.